Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Paymar, and you are listening to The Big Shift, the podcast that looks at the seismic changes our world and our country confront. If there was ever a point in time where the world needs to change, it is right now. We have two major wars raging, one in Europe and one in the Middle East. Millions and scores of countries don't have enough to eat. Climate change is foreshadowing catastrophic weather events from rising seas to ferocious storms and incinerating droughts. Joining us to discuss how we might move forward through the darkness to the light is world-renowned virtuoso cellist Michael Fitzpatrick. Michael has literally traveled the world using music as a vehicle for increasing peace and compassion for humankind. He's performed the musical keynote for Pope Francis at the Vatican. He also performed numerous keynotes for the Dalai Lama's public talks. Fitzpatrick served as co-music director of the Muhammad Ali Humanitarian Awards. Michael, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us today on The Big Shift.
Great to be here, Jim.
So, Michael, you've more or less made it your life's mission to try and help create a more peaceful world through your music. I heard you play years ago at a retreat center in the Catskill Mountains, and I have to tell you, it was mesmerizing. I've seen pictures of you performing from mountaintops to caves in front of world leaders. When did you first start playing the cello, and why?
Well, the when was age 10, which nowadays is late. Yo-Yo Ma started when he was 4. His parents were very strict with him. And so he had to practice multiple hours every day from that young of an age. I come from a musical family on my mother's side. Her mother was a first generation from Poland, and her father was first generation from the Ukraine. So it was in the family, and my grandmother Rose indicated that she would support my studies if I learned to play the cello. And so it started kind of normally, if you will. My parents never imposed any hourglass on me that I had to practice a certain amount every day. And so I just kind of took to it like a kid would. But then along the way, connected with an extraordinary cello teacher in New York City who basically turned my game around and said, if you want to do this, you can take it as far as you want to go, but you're going to have to really, really practice. So that was the beginnings.
You must have had talent to begin with, or you wouldn't have been taking cello lessons.
I was actually a child singer and was discovered by my third grade music teacher, Mrs. Brunsman. We were living in Yellow Springs, Ohio. It was 1971, so you can think of the post-60s haze is still lingering in the air, and you know, it's a little town of 5,000 people. I just thought everybody lived in a town with arboretum and a glen, and so I must have somehow been standing out in the music class when I was singing. So she pulled me aside and said, "I'd like you to sing a solo for next week's parents' gathering," and I stepped up to the microphone and just kind of belted it out. But I did have at that young age. I guess I was 9 then. I had a sense of the electricity or the electrical field that you step into when sound hits a microphone.
Michael, I'd like to take a couple of minutes and give our audience a chance to hear the music that you play with your cello, because until they hear it, I don't think they can really understand or comprehend just what a magnificent artist you are. So let's just take a moment. Thank you. absolutely beautiful. Poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said that music is the universal language of mankind. From your vast experience playing all around the globe, how can music truly make a difference in times of deep distress like we have right now?
The fundamental question that I've been sitting with, this is a position that nobody expected the world to be in at this moment.
No.
So there's shock, there's sorrow, there's righteous anger, there's disbelief. And particularly for those of us that are Jewish, such as myself, even though my last name doesn't give that away, there's a memory. And it goes back. My relative on my Polish side was legendary violinist named Bronislaw Huberman, who founded the Israel Philharmonic. He personally raised the funds and got 1,000 of the finest Jewish musicians out of Eastern Europe and into then Palestine. And the orchestra gave its premier performance in 1936 with the great Arturo Toscanini conducting. So, you know, these were Einstein was behind it. It was a gigantic assemblage. And all I know is, based on in large measure, the amount of time I've spent on the stage, sitting next to the Dalai Lama, playing this particular piece that I composed called Invocation of the Earth, if I sound it right, it has an effect on the listener at a cellular level. This is my perception. At the level of the cells, and again, this is my sort of mythos, if you will, cells have dormant light switches that will get turned on if a very particular vibration triggers them. And when those switches turn on, then there is a luminosity that fills the body, literally. It's at the quantum level. And so you get a biophysical reaction that can be quite blissful. It can be very peace-filling. This oft overused word, compassion, when you really get into the heart of compassion, it's a very strange blend of tears and joy. And so when those emotions start to release and flood the system, it acts as a balm, sort of a sonic cleansing, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then you yourself feel more centered, more within yourself, a feeling of peace. And from there, it makes it different when you're approaching a catastrophic situation, because you're not reacting out of a kind of a crouched position. You're responding out of a very centered place, which the athletes would essentially call being in the zone.
It sounds like music ignites endorphins in your
That's
brain.
That's a great way to say it. Yeah.
And it kind of sets off a feeling and a emotion and, as you said, centers yourself. Mm-hmm. Michael, music exists in every society with and without words. People use music to soothe the soul, to forget their troubles, to find happiness. Now, you've performed at major venues around the world and played with some of the most prestigious symphonies, including the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. And you mentioned just a moment ago that you have a Jewish background. When you think back about that performance, what were you feeling? What was happening at that point in time? And then when you see what's happening in Israel today, what thoughts come to mind?
It was 2016. I was thoroughly overwhelmed by the feeling of being in Jerusalem. I'd been there when I was 2 with my parents, but had no memory of that. When I stepped onto the stage, I was highly mindful of my relative having founded the Israel Philharmonic, which is in Tel Aviv. The piece that I played was written by a credible Jewish composer named Ernest Bloch, Bloch, called Shlomo, which was basically King Solomon's cello concerto. So everything was aligned, and the piece carries the soul and voice of ancient Israel. It's quite powerful, archetype-raising work, and it's also not easy. There were multiple kind of thought trains that were running through my head, but fundamentally I was intent on sounding a call, if you will, that would go out, you know, as far as I could project it to the planet, which is sort of a phenomenon that happens when I'm playing sometimes. You get a sense of the whole world as a single body, if you will. Looking back on it, from this context of what's happening in Israel now, it's taken on an added kind of weight to it.
Michael, tell me about your connection to the Dalai Lama. He said of you, his sound is clear light. How did you come together with His Holiness? You've performed a number of times, I think at least 17 times with him. Can you give us a feeling for that experience and what the Dalai Lama is all about and what he's like?
Well, to paraphrase Buckminster Fuller, where I ended up was different than where I set out to. But then it turned out to be the right place. I was on my way out to Hollywood with Rock and Roll Dreams. We're talking 1994. And I grew up in Kentucky after having lived in Yellow Springs. I'd been to New York. I'd been to Chicago. And I was sort of following my Go West, Young Man mantra. And things got a little bit delayed, if you will. And so I ended up back in Kentucky, kind of regrouping, trying to get a better feel for what was possible. What could one do with the cello in the soon-to-be 21st century that would make a difference? And lo and behold, I got a call from some folks. There's a famous monastery in Kentucky, the Abbey of Gethsemane, which was the home of the late Thomas Merton, who had forged a friendship with the Dalai Lama in 68. But then that got cut short because Merton gets electrocuted in this freak accident. So the Dalai Lama is devastated. He pledges he's going to devote the rest of his life to fulfill Merton's wish to bring East and West together in compassion. My colleague says, oh, the Dalai Lama is coming to spend 6 days at this remote monastery. It's essentially a Super Bowl summit of the world's most renowned monks and nuns from the East and West. And hopefully they're going to come up with some solutions for a world that was becoming increasingly stressed with its operating system. Right. And this was before 9/11. So it was quite advanced thinking on their part. I had no experience of the Dalai Lama, had not read anything about him. I knew he'd won the Nobel Prize. That was pretty much it. I'd been on my own kind of a spiritual journey up to that point. So I'd done readings in Eastern philosophy, and I was aware that there are purportedly beings on this planet who carry vast ancient wisdom that are operating at a supranormal level. Maybe he's like that.
Right.
Well, after 6 days of sitting in the same room with him and the 50 monks and nuns and sitting literally right next to him for the final closing tribute to Thomas Merton, I can say from my own experience, when you're in his presence, it's not at all about him. You feel yourself looking from behind your eyeballs for the first time. He carries a very deep vibration, even though he's very joyous and upbeat. There's a depth to his energy that you can feel. And when you, as a musician, when you play into that, it is an energy field. When you play into that, his energy alters your energy. And then you've got to figure out, okay, I'm either going to hang on and I'm going to go with this, or it's going to blow me out of the water. And that was not an option, you know, because I had to play. And so that was how it started. And I felt an unspoken, decidedly telepathic bond with him. Like I had the sense that he knew me, that he knew my soul. And that was unmistakable. And I figured, okay, that was it. It was an incredible 6 days. I was going out on a Broadway tour. I was going to eventually get to Hollywood. But lo and behold, his people and the Vatican's people who had co-produced the whole summit said, we feel that the music can most powerfully and effectively transmit this new feeling of compassionate consciousness that got forged over the 6 days as a result of the dialogues and the sitting together in silent meditation. And I thought, well, that's quite a radical thing that they're positing. And that was kind of my sense. But I thought, well, I'm just the musician. I'm not in on the monk and nun territory. And this vision flashed in my mind of Tibetan monks and chanting together inside the largest cave in the world, which is Mammoth Cave, which is just a stone's throw from the monastery. And I thought, that's kind of a dramatic sight, the idea of going into the womb of the earth, the acoustics. And so I suggested it to them, thinking there was no way they were possibly going to go for it. And they said, well, it's a great idea, let's do it.
Well, this is when you were, I guess, conceiving the filming of Tuning the Planet, right?
That is correct, right.
Were you and a group of Tibetan monks descended mm-hmm. in the heart of Mammoth Cave mm-hmm. In Kentucky, where you grew up, as you said, mm-hmm. in search of a new vibration, musical voice of the earth itself. What did you hear in the depths of the cave with these monks? What do you hope to produce in this film mm-hmm. when you do get it done?
Well, one of the fundamental questions was, what is the sound of the cave? Mm-hmm. So we went in with an acoustics team and did a very sophisticated set of acoustic tests that essentially consisted of clapping one's hands and stomping one's feet.
Well, that'll do it.
That did it. And the particular chamber that we found that was ideal was not a deeply resonant, echoey space. It was a very crystalline, clear space that didn't have any acoustic wobble to it. It was quite pristine. Playing the cello into that space, it almost had a sound of dry ice, if that would have a sound. But you get the picture of that. It was a sizzling, silvery kind of current. When the Tibetan monks started chanting, you definitely felt the chamber vibrating. And when Brother Paul, who was the lead Trappist monk, that was chanting, his very Gregorian chant can get kind of aspirational to heaven sounding. You had the sense of how far down inside of the earth we were. But the other part of the question was, what were we trying to hear? And what I was intent on hearing was, on a metaphysical or allegorical level, what was the earth's message? Mm-hmm. You know, if the earth could communicate with us, what was the message? What I came back with was, come together.
Uh-huh. I remember that Beatles song.
Indeed. Right. And, you know, it's like, okay, so those guys figured it all out and they broadcast it. And then life went on. Mm-hmm. Oblah di, oblah da. And here we are all these decades later, back in the crucible of a planet at war, much as Vietnam was raging back then. And there's a great plate in the Joseph Campbell Power of Myth book that shows Moses with his staff, and the followers are sort of down below him, and there's a spring of water. And it says Moses was only able to draw water from the spring due to his followers' intense thirst. So at the point of greatest need, works of art, works of music, works of beauty will either rise out of the chaostrophe and wake us up to some kind of design solutions, which at the moment we can't perceive, or, as Buckminster Fuller again would have said, humanity will have failed its final exam.
That's a great line. You know, let's back up for a minute to mm-hmm. come together and Oblah di, Oblah da. You connected with my all-time favorite band. You know, mm-hmm. the Beatles to me are just phenomenal mm-hmm. musicians. How did it come to be that you got together with the Beatles? And their producer, Sir George Martin, said, Michael Fitzpatrick is beyond a marvelous musician. Music is the only thing that can change the world. So everyone says music can change the world, but look at the state of the world.
Well, they asked John Lennon at one point, fundamentally what you're asking, which was like, well, you didn't save the world. And he said, well, imagine a world in which the Beatles hadn't existed, right? So extract it out. And it really is the We Shall Overcome, Eyes on the Prize, Seven Generations. It's a long walk. I remember one time I was talking with Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary, who's an enlightened prophet in his own right. I floated this notion of altering the lyrics of We Shall Overcome to We Have Overcome. This was a number of years ago, and it seemed like things were all right. And he said, my brother, it's always striving. It's always we shall. It's always moving and reaching forward.
At the same time, there are these forces of evil that are suppressing our ability to live together as a human race.
Well, without a doubt. And as Golda Meir said, you know, it's no point trying to make peace with somebody who's trying to kill you. And right. And so the rules of engagement, and I felt this when I was over in Normandy this recent June for the 79th anniversary of D-Day, in this little town of St. Mary Glees, which was the first French town town that was liberated by the Allies after they crashed Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. And when you step foot on this soil, it's kind of like when you step foot in Jerusalem, the history is alive, mm-hmm. you know, and you feel it and it breaks you. I don't care how strong a person you are, it just breaks you. And that was the design solution, that it had to be eradicated. Otherwise, the world would have gone to hell. And that's, in my opinion, the situation in Israel right now. The notion, and I'm just going to say this because we should not be hesitant about speaking truth to falsehood. There is no option for the Israelis other than to decimate the evildoers. Then talk about peaceful resolution. Then talk about all of the other humanitarian rights and responsibilities of the Palestinian people and how the coexistence can happen. But that's not the context, even though obviously the restraint is required in terms of the operation. So, you know, I wouldn't be foolish to propose putting on a concert right now. That's madness. This is a different situation.
It's the same thing as with Adolf Hitler. It had to be unconditional surrender.
That's right.
Same thing in Japan. It had to be unconditional surrender, because these people will never give up. They will regroup. They will fight another day and slaughter another day. We don't want to go too far down that path today. I'd like to kind of flip back to another incredible human being in my book anyway, Pope Francis. Now, you have met Pope Francis. You played at the Vatican. That had to be quite a moment. Tell us about that.
Well, it was. I mean, you know, you hear about these places. It's hard to fathom them, right?
Just being at the Vatican. I've been there a couple of times.
Okay, right.
I've seen Pope Francis. I was there after Pope John Paul II passed away. And I know the feeling of just being on the exterior, but I've never met the Pope.
Well, it's location, location, location. As we used to say in Hollywood, it's all about being on the lot. So once you get on the lot, then you're like, oh, okay, I get it. This is the stage set. And here we have a stage. The particular venue was the 6,000 seat Paul VI audience hall. But there were only 200 VIP attendees, including one of the keynotes speeches was given by then Vice President Biden, just flown in from Iraq. So he gave an extraordinarily soulful speech. I then played as the Pope was going through the crowd, basically blessing all of the participants. And then I had a moment with him where we met. And because of all the time I'd spent with the Dalai Lama, at that point it had been, it was 20 years. I'd been going, you know.
With the Dalai Lama?
20 years. So I was familiar with certain protocol. But the ultimate protocol was, how do you meet someone? Right? How do you meet them at the level of their soul, not just their personality, not their rank, not their station, not their power, not their money, not their personality? How do you meet them with none of those trappings? And it had become enough of an instinct in me that when I had my moment with the Pope, we locked eyes, and then we both just started laughing, because it's just, there's some strange phenomenon that happens. That was it.
That was your connection with him.
Yeah.
Everything I've read and everything I've seen about him, he seems to be an extraordinarily humble man.
He was totally humble. He was completely down to earth.
You also were the recipient of the Prince Charles Award for Musical Excellence, conferred by His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, who is now King Charles III. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, did you meet the Prince of Wales when he was the Prince of Wales? And why were you given this award?
So in the theater of the music business, which can often include the theater of the absurd and the theater of imagination, one of my mentors and champions of my early career was Giancarlo Menotti, who had founded the Spoleto Festival in Italy. And Menotti wrote The Saint of Bleecker Street, A Mall and the Night Visitors, a famous play with music called The Telephone. He kind of pioneered this crossover theater musical operatic form and won the Pulitzer Prize, made, I think, an enormous amount of money. And set up the Italian equivalent of the Aspen Music Festival in the mountains of Spoleto, Italy, which is about an hour and a half outside of Rome. In Menotti's family, this is how I've heard the story, he had a niece who married a member of the British royal family, and Menotti was also friends with this marvelous woman named Countess Gaia Pallavicini, whose family, the House of Pallavicini, had installed the first pope in the 12th century, and was the wealthiest woman in Italy, and was friends with Prince Charles and everybody else. As far as I can figure, they had a conversation, and it was agreed that there should be, that Prince Charles would bestow an award to the outstanding musician of the Spoleto Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular summer, I happened to have been given a solo in this European premiere of a symphony that the whole second movement was basically a cello solo. It was, mm-hmm. it was really difficult because it was super, super slow.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no place to hide. And I practiced an enormous amount, and the concert went extremely well. The next day, I heard from Giancarlo Menotti that I had been awarded the Prince Charles Award, which I didn't even know about its existence. So there was a ceremony with the British ambassador to Italy, and that's a whole tale that unfolded. But it was a pivot for me because it gave me an accolade that was unique.
I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. And someday, hopefully soon, I will be able to personally thank His Majesty King Charles III.
That would be, can I come along?
Sure.
Well, I'll pay my own way.
Fair enough. I'll meet you in Spoleto.
Okay. You've been doing this your entire life. You're a guy from Kentucky. You've been all around the world. I'm just wondering what's up next for you. You don't seem to stay in one place very long. Follow your career. Who gets to hear you in the near future?
Well, the next big thing up is the 80th anniversary of D-Day, so June 6, 2024. And as a result of having performed this past June, I have a much better sense of the lay of the land, the cast of characters. This past June, I had a really strong connection with now retired General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and his wife, Holly. Mm-hmm. Man, it was extraordinary human beings. I had the privilege of playing at a VIP general's dinner for all of the four-star generals whose battalions had fought in the Second World War. Extraordinary human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Just the best and the brightest. So this next June, everything goes to the presidential level. King Charles III will be there at Omaha Beach with President Biden, Macron. So there's a lot of preparation going into that. There are other initiatives that I'm currently pioneering. One is the new OmniSonics Music for the Healing Journey, which we've just recorded. And you can check out the website, which is omnisonics.org, but it's spelled OmniSonics as an ode to Mr. Jimi Hendrix at the end there. And so we're going to be doing healing music outreach, taking this music into the front lines, the hospital bedsides, military hospitals, hospice, elderly care centers, any place where the music can immediately make a difference regardless of what's happening in the world at large.
I have looked at a lot of your videos and I've seen you in person. And when you play the cello, your eyes are closed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like you and that instrument are one and you don't need to see anything.
Hmm.
Do I have that right or wrong?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Your spiritual quest and your music, are they one and the same?
Yeah, it's the same. And there's a great line in Martin Scorsese's film, The Last Waltz, when Robbie Robertson and the band, they're sitting around, they're talking about strange places that they ended up. And Robbie Robertson says, you know, the music took us to some places that we ordinarily would never have gone to. And if there was one way I had to sum up what this, my journey has been to this point, it would be that. Once I connected with the Dalai Lama, then I took the fork in the road and I went off the trail, off the map of any conventional cello player would have ever done. They stay in the system, right?
Orchestra, symphonies.
Yeah, or, you know, yo-yo is was the last of the great soloists.
Right.
Okay, and there's not going to be another one of him. Uh-huh. Right? It's just that game is going extinct. How long it takes, which is not to say that there won't be other cello soloists, but nobody will be able to take that amount of real estate that he took.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was coming up through the ranks, even as early as 82, I was a freshman at the Cleveland Institute of Music. I remember writing in my journal, Yo-Yo Ma is the last stop on the train. When he gets mm-hmm. off, nobody else gets on. Which was kind of, yeah, that was a little daunting.
There might not be another 3 or 4 year old like Yo-Yo Ma that just is a prodigy who could come up. And
there will, they exist. But I mean, Yo-Yo had a magic that was Beatlesque.
Yeah,
it really was. That you're born with that. You can't learn that. But he already, just in terms of, well, Picasso comes to mind, of somebody that sort of exhausted all the styles.
Right.
Yo-Yo has exhausted all the styles. But going back to the fork in the road, when I was looking at it all, I thought, well, what if the cello became a compositional vehicle
mm-hmm.
of my own making? What if I use that instrument to expand into places that a cello would not have sounded before? And what if I used it much more in the spirit of the late, great Pablo Casals as an instrument of peace? He's been my guide star.
What could we do? I'm not a musician, but I'm trying to bring your thoughts and your spirit and your musical excellence to a bunch of people who will listen to this. What can we do as a human species to push the kind of music that you're talking about that does ignite the soul, that does ignite the brain, that does bring us together as human beings? How do we push the music mm-hmm. out there? I mean, mm-hmm. there are societies out, like the Taliban. They don't right. want any music.
No, that's exactly right.
And there's got to be a reason for that, because they feel that music would indoctrinate people into maybe thinking differently.
Or feeling differently.
Acting differently mm-hmm. towards each mm-hmm. other. So do you see a road? Do you see a pathway to penetrate these societies that will not allow basic musical expression?
So I'm going to not directly answer your question, but indirectly answer it by saying the way out that I can see is to commission new works, to create new types of projects, to bring forth musical material that, and I'm not talking about me, I'm just talking about, you know, musicians around the planet right now who are facing impossible odds in a world that's been Spotified. So the landscape of the Beatles and the Eagles and these great rock and roll bands, you could go down the list, Alan Parsons, that it's gone.
Yeah.
And people don't pay for music anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the artists basically have to become hustlers with mm-hmm. their material, pitchmen.
Right.
Right. And I find it rather
distressing,
unpalatable. It is distressing to see Ringo Starr is out there, you know, hustling his new album and pitching mm-hmm. and McCartney doing sales pitches. It's like, really?
You get it all for free. Not for free. I mean, you pay Spotify and you can listen to just about anything you want to listen to. You do get paid. The artists do get paid by Spotify and by iTunes every time their music is played. So isn't it just a different format? It's a digital format rather than, you know, buying a record or buying a CD.
If you like the math that for 1 million streams on Spotify, the artist gets $4,000.
That does not sound like a good deal.
That is not a good deal. And what does Spotify get? We don't know what that number is, but it's more than 4,000.
Yeah, they're making a fortune.
So I'm a big fan of the movie Tron. Remember Tron with Jeff mm-hmm. Bridges? It's like we have to get on these light cycles and ride the grid and figure out essentially how to we have to build a new grid and then navigate the new grid. All of this is possible because at every juncture in history, there's always been some unsolvable design challenge that
mm-hmm.
then, you know, Einstein comes up with it, or the electric car gets invented, or it's endless.
We're in a constant state of transition.
That's it.
So there's another phase coming, and we don't even know what it is. It might be someone might be working on it in the background right now as we speak.
There is no question about it. You know, if you read Rupert Sheldrake and his morphogenetic field theory, which is essentially the 100th monkey idea, that somehow things can happen simultaneously in different parts of the world through a connecting, we go back to that field of energy I was talking about at the beginning. So that is emerging, and it's the pressure of the crisis that is forcing it out. And we have to be, I have to remind myself, well, Ringo said it. They asked him, is there going to be another Beatles? he said, of course. He said, obviously it's not going to be us.
Right.
Even though they're back on the top of the charts, but the innovative musicians who are doing it beyond getting rich and famous and being rock stars, but who have a particular focus of their conscience to using the music to uplift and elevate. And that stuff can be, that could sound like anything. It could sound like rock and roll. It could sound like salsa. It could sound symphonic. It's not the style, but it is the vibe.
You know, just closing out on that, Michael, because we're running out of time here. Is there a way to create a vibe that kind of transcends all of the negativity that we're feeling today and seeing today? I mean, there is a wave of depression out there, teen suicide, the warfare that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. How do we get a musical vibe or any kind of vibe out there that would help us just live together? Do you see hope?
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, you can't give up hope.
Yeah.
Then the game's over.
Right.
So never give up, never give in. I absolutely do. And we can look to history to see the precedents for it. You know, if anybody would have ever predicted in 1959 that four guys, well, John Lennon and the Beatles knew, but that four guys, you know, were playing in a cellar in Hamburg, were going to change the world, which they did, right, in 8 years. So, which is a good long run. Think about it, how much their music evolved from basically dance love songs to, you know, songs about what's possible if we do come together.
Right.
So that will happen again because we go through these cycles. But just in closing, the words that come through these songs now have to speak to the global climate and context that we're in. We're not in the 60s. We're not in the 70s. Mm-hmm. We're approaching the middle of the 2020s, which is kind of crazy.
Right.
So if we don't have language that can be really interesting language that articulates in a musical, entertaining way, well, then, as McCartney sang, we just got a bunch of silly love songs, which that's not going
to
do it.
Just in closing, I mean, it is like a pendulum swinging from right to left. I mean, we've got cancel culture right now. We've got societies that are banning music because they think it's detrimental to your mental health. And, you know, you're going to be an opposition politician or whatever it might be. Somehow we've got to all get back on a track together.
Yeah.
And move forward together, or this is not going to be a very pleasant place to live. But I share your vision of hope, and let's just keep the faith, baby.
Yeah, totally.
Well, listen, Michael, great speaking with you as always. If you'd like to know more about Michael Fitzpatrick, you can go to his website. It's michaelfitzpatrick.com, just like you'd spell it, michaelfitzpatrick.com. And if you're interested in purchasing his music, go to www.omnisonics.org. He mentioned that earlier. It's omnisonix.org. And you'll see a long, long list of Michael's recordings. And Michael, again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for being so open to the possibility of breakthrough, as we used to say back in the day.
Let's break through.
Break on through. Totally.
And I'm Jim Paymar, and you have been listening to The Big Shift, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening today, and stay tuned for the next episode of The Big Shift. It's coming soon.